Temperatures are low, spirits are high, because people know 2018 just can't be as weird as 2017. Just in case, let's create a diversion. This is Spectrum West. Hi, everybody. I'm Al Ross. This week, the music of David Gerald, a blues soul rocker who plays guitar like ringing a bell. You know how good that is. He's coming from Detroit to light up the Heidi Center Saturday evening. Jim Oliver's here to share his conversation with Michael Norman, writer of haunting stories people say are true all over America's heartland. Jim will also impart what's on stage up, down, and across western Wisconsin. Young dancer Emily Emerson is at it again. This time she and some agile and musical friends will light up and warm up a late January evening. She waltzed into the studio with details. And this is where the first endeavor of 2018 begins.
That'll be the day when you say goodbye. That'll be the day when you make me cry. Say you're gonna leave me. You know it's a lie, 'cause that'll be the day.
The Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts, in a bit of turmoil as it begins a search to replace colorful director Steve Renfrey, affixes blinders and charges into the new year this Saturday with a performance by Colleen Ray and company in the background there. The popular singer and producer with interests and connections throughout the Midwest has put together yet another musical tribute show. We spoke with her by phone earlier this week. Well, there was a brief moment in history when Colleen was affectionately known as Reed Grimm's mom. And to refresh people's memory, Reed Grimm was the West Wisconsin kid who went far down the American Idol road, and he's still doing music. Give us an update for those who want to know.
Well, Reed is still performing, doing a lot of different things. The big thing he's doing right now is finishing up his very first solo album.
Ooh.
He has a lot of his friends that have worked with him in Shoeless Revolution and mm-hmm. new people he's met. He has strings on some, which I was surprised because he's been posting it on Facebook.
Oh, cool.
And there's this whole string section he has in one of them. And all of them are his originals.
Okay. Is there a release date? When's it coming out?
If all goes well, the release date is in April, but he might be doing a single before that. They release singles out before the main thing. Yeah, that's what we're hoping for. Everything's pretty much wrapping up right now. I just talked to him yesterday, and he is so excited about it, as we all are.
Next time you talk to him, tell him not to forget old Uncle Al and tell him to keep me posted on how things are going.
I absolutely will. As a matter of fact, we were talking about on the phone the other day, how you guys connected back then, and, it was kind of a nice relationship you guys developed.
Oh, it was a lot of fun. Lunching with a celebrity at the time. People coming up going, oh, I love you on the show, man. So I just kind of went, yeah, I'm cool. I'm with Reed Grimm. Of course, Colleen Ray, who passed some musical genes along to Reed and others, is well-known as an entertainer, very much so in her own right, appearing to have a ball at everything that she does. Did I read correctly that you're now involved in 9 shows, different shows?
Yes. Well, not just involved in them. I wrote them all created them all, and I actually am like the business manager. Pretty much they're all my babies. So happy to be able to be doing it at this point in my life and mm-hmm. people liking it and coming out and having fun. And
well, I mean, you're sitting around and along comes another idea, another compilation. Aren't you tempted to say, like the TV show, 8 is enough? I mean,
I kind of am. But some of the shows, like, for instance, the one that we're doing at the Mabel Tainter, that's with Wayne Lukow and myself and my sister. He's a wonderful voice. He does Roy Orbison music and Gene Pitney, and then we're doing Linda Ronstadt stuff. But I had seen him before, and he called me up saying, I really kind of want to get these shows out there, and what do you think? And I said, well, if you trust me to write a show around you and mm-hmm. around us, my sister will be in it. I know how to do shows, and I knew he had a lot of stuff kind of put together already, so it wasn't starting from scratch.
Okay.
So that happened with him. That's how one show came. The idea is already there. A lot of the music's in place. Now it's a matter of spicing it up, putting in the right order, adding some things, getting some costumes, figuring out what you're going to do for a set. you know, but the basic core of the music is there. That happened with him and also with Tim Patrick and the Blue Eyes Band. I do a Sinatra and Company Rat Pack show with him and his 10-piece band. And then also we just did a holiday show, brand new holiday show. But it's just so fun to create.
What's the first show that you did of this kind of thing?
The first one was the Girl Singers of the Hit Parade. The music of Patti Page, Peggy Lee, Connie Francis, Doris Day, and Rosemary Clooney. And that was with my sisters and my two daughters in a band.
Colleen Ray on the phone with us. That'll Be the Day is the name of the show. It's coming Saturday to the Mabel Tainter in Menominee. Showtime is 7:30. The music of Roy Orbison, Gene Pitney, and Linda Ronstadt. I am personally happy to see someone doing Gene Pitney music. He had some great makeout songs years ago, and you and you don't hear about him that much.
Well, the singer I'm working with, Wayne Lukow, knew all of his songs and kind of and sings them so well.
All right.
But also, you know, Gene Pitney was out working. He was doing his music in Europe and all over the place until I think it was 2006 when he passed away after a show, by the way.
Wow.
And there was a PBS special with all of his music, and he worked with a lot of people up here in the cities, right here in Minneapolis.
Oh, he did.
All over here.
People should feel free in the crowd to put their arm around their significant other and remember Only Love Can Break a Heart. And
I love that's my favorite one.
Isn't that that's a good song. But again,
I love that one.
It brought out the amorous in young people back when I was a kid. You're kind of serious about what you do. I mean, there is Colleen Ray Productions now. A cool, like, fireworks logo at the end of videos that I saw. I watched the video preview of this particular show. That was pretty neat.
Oh, great. You know, actually, I learned how to put those together, too. Do you believe that? I'm learning so much. Yeah, it's been great. At first, it was Girl Singers LLC, because it was mostly girl singer shows.
Mm-hmm.
So I just put it under Colleen Ray Productions. You know, it has some continuity for all of them.
Okay, just so that we keep throwing out an hors d'oeuvre or two, what can Saturday's Mabel Tainter audience expect to see and hear? Tantalize us.
I will. Well, there is so many great songs. I myself sing Blue Bayou. That's Linda Ronstadt.
Yes,
you know
yes.
that Roy Orbison also wrote that.
That's a good song.
And we do from her, When Will I Be Loved, Desperado, Mr. Sandman, with three parts. That was done with Emmylou Harris and Dolly Parton and Linda Ronstadt. And we jokingly say that Wayne has to play the part of Emmylou Harris because, you know, we need the third one. So he comes in. And, you know, they had that whole album where they did the trio. So we have that in there.
All right.
And then, of course, Wayne singing Crying and Pretty Woman. And
oh, boy.
Only the Lonely. We get the audience singing dum 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 de doo ah.
Oh, yeah.
And then with Gene Pitney, he would write songs for all these other people too. He wrote a song for the Crystals called He's a Rebel. Debbie and I sing that one. And then for Ricky Nelson, Hello Mary Lou, he wrote that one.
What a guy.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah, he wrote there's a lot more that I even remember. But he wrote a lot of songs, and what's kind of fun about him is he was a really good musician, too. And his very first song, which was Love My Life Away, before all the computers and the easy way to put things together, he, in his garage, put all the tracks down, seven vocal tracks, the piano, the drums, the bass, everything, in his garage. It cost him $35, and that was his first hit.
Wow.
He's got quite a story. It's really fun. You remember his theme song, 24 Hours from Tulsa?
Yes, I do, yes.
Town Without Pity.
Oh, yeah, those were all
those. And Debbie and I, that's my sister, Debbie O'Keefe from Hudson, we're involved in singing all of those songs. We're either singing backgrounds, we share them with Wayne, or we're doing solos, but we're always up there with them.
Did you sing as young sisters, too?
She's like 9 years younger than I am. That's a big difference when you're younger. But when I went out on the road, I had four kids. In fact, when I was expecting, I was singing through my whole pregnancy. And they said they want another girl on the road with me because that was back in the day when, she's pregnant on stage, you know. So we got Debbie out there. She was only 13, so that was the other girl we got. She came out and sang with us, and we were doing different things from Broadway popular numbers. And that was when I was on the road with Steve Grimm, my then husband, Steve Grimm and Colleen Ray.
So. Boy, that all makes sense. I love the fact, too, that if you see the title, That'll Be the Day, you get surprised a little bit thinking that it's going to be a Buddy Holly show, and it doesn't turn out to be that. It turns out to be Linda Ronstadt, because her version was cool, too.
That's a fun song to sing. We're going to include Buddy Holly music in there, but it just got to be so much to put in one show. Buddy Holly's got shows all by himself with all his stuff. But we still like that. It's hard to come up with names that kind of...
I hear you.
...that grab you. That's the I think that's one of the hardest...
Yeah, I mean, how many people would come to a show called Town Without Pity? That just wouldn't... it wouldn't be a draw. Menominee is a town without pity? What the heck is up with that?
Yeah.
Not sure. I like that. Well, everybody's going to have fun Saturday night at the Mabel Tainter in Menominee. I think now that you're at 9, you might as well go to 10. What the heck?
Right. I'm thinking about it. I got one of mine.
The music of Tiny Tim. How's that?
You know, I've got people in my band that have worked with him because he did a bunch of stuff up in Minneapolis.
I know.
There might be something to be said for that.
Colleen Ray Productions. Be the mogul. Be the producer. Colleen, thanks. Always a pleasure. Fun talking to you. And keep in touch with us here at WPR.
We sure will. Thank you so much. I always love chatting with you.
Give me a chance to make up for the harm.
There's that song that she and I both agreed is a wonderful one, yes. Saturday evening, 7:30, Mabel Tainter, Center for the Arts, MabelTainter.org. That is the website. That'll be the day, starring Colleen Ray and friends.
Please let me hold you.
Oh, wow. All the best to the people whose job it is to keep the proud Tainter legacy going. And to Steve Renfrey for landing on your feet. It's been fun. This is Spectrum West. Coming up, David Gerald music. And Spectrum West is also one of Jim Oliver's favorite haunts. Did you know that? Yeah. Support for WPR comes from Luther College in Decorah, Iowa, offering over 60 areas of study, including new majors in data science and neuroscience, dedicated to preparing students for a changing world. Luther.edu. Some people are veterans in the field of artistic endeavor, and then there are those relatively new to the art of entertainment. But although young in years, they'll be veterans in no time simply because they display the energy to do what needs being done along the road of experience. One such young lady is Emily Emerson, who was here in August for a preview of her Eau Claire Dance Festival Act 1, and who's back with something called Incandescence, a performance to remind us that in the dead of winter, our imaginations can make us warm. I looked it up in the archives, and it was August 24th, that program, when we first heard about your energy for providing a unique stage for dance, the Eau Claire Dance Festival Act 1. So how has Emily Emerson been spending her time in nearly 5 months that have passed since then?
Well, I've been at school. I go to St. Olaf College, and there I had to work on my senior capstone project, which was for my dance major.
Okay.
So I've been busy choreographing. So far, that is the biggest project I've done. But I'm sure Dance Festival is going to challenge me and just keep me choreographing bigger and bigger things.
Yeah. We're recording this on Tuesday, and you're leaving to go back to school today, and yet you have to coordinate a show at the end of January in Eau Claire. How's that going to happen?
The biggest hurdle with that was going to be getting dancers who I could rehearse with, because unlike Act 1, this one is going to have very little improvisation. So it's going to be choreographed, made ahead of time, and learned ahead of time, instead of improvisation, where it's created on the spot as the person is doing it.
Sure.
I had to have dancers that were nearby that I could rehearse with. So all of the dancers, there are four of us total, I'm dancing in part of it, and the other three also go to St. Olaf. One of them is an Eau Claire native as well, and the other two are local to the area.
I was able to take in your performance at the Volume 1 headquarters. That was kind of neat. On Act 1, we didn't do an immediate follow-up to Act 1. How do you assess it? How did it go?
There were definitely some hurdles, but overall, people seemed really pleased with it, and that made me happy. I was happy mostly that we just got something out there. As many hurdles as there were, it did go well, in my opinion. But I certainly learned things, what to do, what not to do. We found some really, really great musicians mm-hmm. who love playing for dance and are incredibly talented. They're performing again for Incandescence, our upcoming event.
The event I saw, the Volume 1, had Nick Butler reading, and he seemed to be enjoying himself. I was watching his face to see how he would react, and he would read a passage and then watch the dancing, and he seemed pretty proud of what people were doing with his stuff.
Yeah, he said that he would be interested in doing it again sometime.
So now comes Incandescence, or as I said it the first time, Incandescence. which is kind of a
little punny.
Sure. And if you look up incandescence, it means glow, fluorescence, radiance, light, luster, and you're adding a little warmth to it. We're talking on a very cold January morning. We could use some incandescence. Adding a few letters to the word light, allow me to ask that you enlighten our audience on what it is you're planning for incandescence.
So the weather has actually been priming people for incandescence. January is notoriously bitter and cold and dark. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that the world needed some light, some warmth. And so the overarching theme of the entire evening, and it'll be about an hour-length show, warmth, light, inspiration, anything that makes you feel that warm, happy feeling inside.
Okay.
With a little contrast as well. You know, you can't have the light without the dark. Reading what some of the writers have submitted so far, there is definitely a dark side to things to kind of parallel the light.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Are they writing special things for this?
Yes, this is all new material that they're writing.
Along the theme of whatever incandescence means.
However they interpret it. And so far there's been very different interpretations of it. There's poetry, there's prose. In one, we actually have poetry and prose kind of in a dueling writers situation.
Banjo music.
Not so much.
That's dueling banjos, isn't it? Yeah. So do they write something with the idea that someone is going to be dancing? Did you say, just write anything and we'll dance to it?
I can't speak to their creative process. I don't know the details exactly. I do know that at least one of the writers has written, keeping in mind that there should be some visual imagery that the dance lines up with. We've actually been working together very closely, and I've been sending them examples of the choreography thus far, which inspires their writing, and then their writing inspires more choreography for me. So it's really a collaborative process there.
Mm-hmm. Now, the musicians who are taking part, who was at Volume 1 the day I saw it?
Tim Sullivan and Jeremy Betcher.
Okay, so they're back in, I see, on this list.
Yeah, and adding in Josh Gallagher as well.
Who's a heck of a keyboard player.
Yeah, he's incredibly talented. We've got a heck of a lineup for musicians.
Then, as dancers, you are thinking in your choreographical way. Incandescence, we're going to look like flames or space heaters, or what are we going
to overall, it's just kind of the emitting part of it. So thinking movement, moving from the center of the body outward.
Mm-hmm.
But also, the writers are providing a lot of beautiful imagery, other warming things. I know in one piece of writing, there is someone sitting around a campfire that's kind of central to the writing piece.
Okay.
So as dancers, we're trying to visually represent that as well as emotionally represent what's going on in the story.
Okay, so now you said that this is less improvisational than your Act One. Is any of it going to be improvisational?
Yes, there will be four movements per se.
Okay.
Not physical movements, but, you know, Act One, Movement One sort of thing.
Like a play.
Like a play.
Or a symphony.
So there'll be four movements in there. There'll be two solos and one duet. All of those are choreographed. But then the fourth movement includes all four of the dancers, as well as all four of the writers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the writers are going to be improvising just like the dancers are. So they are going to be giving us words or phrases that remind them of the incandescence theme. So someone could say campfire or friendship, or, you know, so two things that are tangentially related to it. And then the dancers are going to be improvising as a group based on what those words are.
Ah. Emily Emerson in the studio with us. We are talking, as we did back in August, about dancing, modern dance specifically. It back then was the Eau Claire Dance Festival Act One. This is Incandescence, coming the end of January the 26th. I had an idea for you. August was some outdoor stuff. Mm-hmm. Dancing would be a way to stay warm outdoors, although you're not going to do that because it's too cold. Is there such a thing as cold weather dancing? And then I said to myself, you know, I've actually seen people dancing on street corners trying to keep warm, and that would actually make either a great video, or you could offer keep warm choreography for people, and that could be a YouTube craze. You could say, here's a great dance to do on the corner while you're waiting for the bus. So there you go.
Well, thank you. Usually sure. That sort of dancing involves a lot of bouncing and jiggling and shaking of the
Nothing
feet.
Nothing wrong with bouncing and jiggling, I've always said. Good idea, though, huh?
Great idea.
So come up with some street corner staying warm dancing. That could go national. Okay, so that's my tangent. Now you're going back to school. I take it you do take some rather general courses as well. Is it sometimes hard to keep your mind on studies when you are so into dancing?
Definitely. I'm actually a double major. I also major in history as well as dance. So
how about historical dance? You could combine those two. I'm sure that's part of it, yeah.
Actually, for my capstone piece, I did try to combine them, focusing on what history means to people expressed through dance. But I definitely find moments where it's like, I don't want to be reading this textbook. I just want to be dancing, or I just want to be choreographing right now.
I understand that. Okay, so from the dancer's mouth, give us all the details that we need to know about January 26th.
Well, it's at Forage, which is in Banbury Place here in Eau Claire. Mm-hmm. The doors open at 7. The evening starts at 7:30.
Okay.
The runtime is about 1 hour, and there is an intermission. Mm-hmm. Drinks will be available for purchase during intermission and beforehand. The ticket price is $10. You can get your tickets online at the Forage website under the tab of cooking classes and events, or the Eau Claire Dance Festival Facebook page. We also have an event set up for incandescents, and there's a link to the Forage website in there as well.
Okay.
So either place you can get the tickets. I think that's everything.
That's a lot. And thank you for all that. Should we surmise that this is not Act 2? This is just something else?
This is something between Act 1 and Act 2. Act 2 will actually be called Act 2. This is something in between to keep people entertained.
Any idea when Act 2 is coming along? Is that swirling around in your head now?
It's still being discussed. We're still talking about it. We don't have any dates lined up yet. We're trying to coordinate with the musician on that, or the musicians, plural.
Summer thing?
Possibly, maybe. It really depends on other people's schedules.
I like how you're not really telling us anything. That's cool. That makes us more curious. And that's good. That's what promotion's all about. Emily Emerson, thanks so much. Always a pleasure.
Thank you. You as well.
To repeat what you need to know, you can get tickets at the Forage website, forageeauclaire.com. Find the tab Classes and Events, and the Eau Claire Dance Festival Facebook page is a good place to visit as well. This is Spectrum West on WPR. Here's a Spectrum memo for you. Sunday at 7:30 p.m., the River Falls Unitarian Universalist Society hosts a traveling music and poetry roadshow, Roving on a Winter's Night, featuring singer-songwriter brother Timothy Francik. Hope I pronounced that right. Folk duo Fendrick and Peck, and poet Thomas R. Smith. You know, I don't know if his curling up days are still around or behind him, but I do know that Jim Oliver likes to read a good book fairly often. I wonder how he liked reading about many of the mysterious places one can find in Middle America. Let's find out.
Michael Norman is an emeritus professor of journalism at the University of Wisconsin, River Falls. His books include 7 collections of American supernatural stories. His most recent, published by the University of Wisconsin Press, is the 2nd edition of Haunted Heartland. The 1st edition of Haunted Heartland was published in 1985 in collaboration with the late Beth Scott. Michael Norman joins us by telephone from his home in River Falls. Thanks so much for coming on and talking on this chilly day in western Wisconsin.
Well, thank you, Jim. Nice to be with you.
Well, why the 2nd edition? Is there a lot of difference between this one and the earlier one?
Oh, that's a very big question, and one that was perplexing, and one I had to figure out before I started on the 2nd edition. The biggest challenge was that the original edition was published in 1985 and has been in print since that time, in one form or another. Paperback edition, mass market paperback edition, and then another edition that a prominent American bookseller had published and sold in their own stores. So it had been around a long time without any changes. In the meantime, I had, either in collaboration with Beth or alone after she passed away, continued to write several other collections of American ghost stories, and Haunted America, Historic Haunted America, two other national books. I wrote a book about Minnesota ghost stories and legends. I did a couple of new editions of Haunted Wisconsin, including one that just came out 3 or 4 years ago. So I had dealt with sort of heartland or middle western, midwestern ghost stories in these other books. And so the challenge I had was, would there be enough new material to make it worthwhile? Have I covered about every every ghost story I could find? Mm-hmm. And you know, I mean, literally probably a couple of hundred ghost stories among those 7 or 8 books that I've done. And so in discussions with the publisher, you know, they emphasized that it was a second edition. It was, don't worry about it being a new book, a second edition. So I needed, you know, material that would make it worthwhile for readers to purchase the new one, you know, plus updating stories where I could. So it seemed like perhaps a little less of a challenge than I initially thought. I have to have an entirely new book of Midwestern ghost stories? No. And so what this book is a polishing of stories. It's an update of stories where an update was necessary, or where I found some additional information. There are some stories new to this edition, so it's a variety of things, but enough to make it a second edition, not a second book, a second collection, but a second edition. The readers will find most of the original stories there, plus, you know, some new ones. I couldn't say no, and we went forward. Took about a year to work on.
When you got a publisher, I guess you better take advantage of it.
Well, yes, that's good. Well, and they were really wonderful people to work with, both from an editing standpoint and just general support. They could not be better.
Well, your original collaborator was Beth Scott, who has since passed away, and I wanted to ask you about Beth Scott a little bit. Just who was she, and how did you and she work together in terms of doing these books?
Well, fortunately, we both had similar styles. Our first book, Haunted Wisconsin and Haunted Heartland, were the two that we did most of the work on. She passed away in 1994, just before Haunted America was published. And we found early on that our styles meshed. We wanted the books to be journalistic in nature. We wanted to approach them not as believers, someone who is writing these stories from a believer standpoint, but almost investigative reporting, or at least an approach to the story that would tell readers, here's the information, here's what we found, this is what people say happened, you know, and trying to write it in an entertaining and interesting way. And then leave it up to the reader to decide. I've always called myself a skeptic, you know, open-minded skeptic, perhaps. I'm willing to give someone the benefit of the doubt. I've interviewed too many people to think that it's all something that is made up.
We're talking to Michael Norman, who is the author of several collections of the American supernatural stories. The most recent is the second edition of Haunted Heartland. I had asked you before to give us a truncated version of a couple of the stories that are in the books.
Well, it's always hard, you know, picking out stories.
Well, mostly I'd like an idea of just what kind of stories are in the book.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. There are two broad categories, you know, contemporary and historical. You know, the historical ones are often legend and lore. I think virtually every city, you know, has a local haunted house or, you know, a local legend. Many of those places or legends are kind of disappearing from the landscape because we don't tell stories to one another anymore. Others are contemporary. The contemporary stories that we wrote in both the first edition and in this edition, we depend on research, on interviewing people, going to the area, going to the place. Historical stories, my favorite is the one that leads the book, from Illinois, actually, called The Girl on Sheridan Road, main thoroughfare between Chicago and Waukegan. you know, this is a story that combines both a contemporary and historical twist in that drivers on Sheridan Road in the Lake Forest area are reported seeing a woman in a diaphanous gown at the side of the street. They think it's someone whose car has broken down, but then they notice that their headlights shine directly through the woman, and she smiles. And when she smiles, her mouth is blackened like it had been burned. Then in the story, we learn that this is actually a woman killed or died. They're still not sure. Tragic series of events in 1917. And I like that story because it has a lot of historical detail. There was a very well-known, notorious trial of a young man who was accused of killing this woman. Most stories, it's hard to find a piece of history that supports, you know, the ghost story. This is one. There's another one from this area, actually, from Pierce County, that is a domestic ghost story, ghost haunting a family in a rather ordinary house. I call it My Three Ghosts, because there were three ghosts in the house, including a little boy, an older lady, and a really mean drunk who used to rent a room in this big old house. So those are a couple, but gee, I mean, there are 80 of them, so
yes, that's
78 more than...
That was my issue, and I begged you to, you know, come up with a couple to talk about. Anyway, what got you interested in ghost stories?
That goes back to my collaboration with Beth. One of the courses that I taught over the years was feature writing. She was a full-time freelance feature writer, and I got to know her as a writer. She lectured in some of my classes, and in a conversation, I raised the idea of book writing, and she was adamant. No, I don't want to write books. I'm very satisfied being a freelance writer. But I said, that's the Mount Olympus for writers, isn't it? You write a book. Today, it's much easier, of course. You know, you just do it yourself. Back then, you had to go through commercial publishers and do all that sort of thing. What about if you started on a book of a lot of short chapters? You've got feature stories, and then pretty soon you'd have a book, right? Don't think of it as a book. Think of it as just a series of chapters. I wouldn't know what to write about. I had read a book of Wisconsin folklore at one time that claimed that Wisconsin had more ghosts per square mile than any other state.
Hmm.
And I said, well, what if we would write a book of ghost stories? Boy Scout troops might buy copies, and Cub Scout troops. So we set out. It sounded like... It'd be something fun to do. It'd be a fun topic to write about. Mm-hmm. Not until much later did I discover that she had actually had an experience with seeing the ghost of her late father-in-law.
Really?
In her house, which is where he had died. And he appeared on the anniversary of death, standing in the doorway of her kitchen, where he looked at her, smiled, and vanished. And I said, well, why didn't you tell me that you had an experience? She said, well, I didn't want people to think that was influencing what I was writing. You know, ever the journalist, right? You know, you don't want to.
Mm-hmm, you bet. You know. Does information fall in your lap like that in other cases? Or how much work is it in just chasing down these stories?
Well, I mean, from the very beginning, I didn't know how we were going to find the information because I wasn't convinced that people were going to start knocking on my door, and I wouldn't want that anyway. You know, I've got a ghost story that I want to tell you. So we just kind of plowed ahead, and it is difficult. On a contemporary basis, I think it's much more acceptable now to talk about ghost stories and ghost legends. There are some TV channels that stream them 24/7. But back then, one of the things I did was I wrote letters to newspapers. You know, we're a couple of writers, and we're working on a book of Wisconsin ghost stories. And if you've got a ghost story or seen a ghost or know of one in your community, let us know. Well, actually, we got quite a few responses. That's how we started with the contemporary ones. Set up interviews and you know, talked to people, went to the places that they talked about. Archivists and librarians were extremely helpful, and many of them have very good collections of newspaper articles about all kinds of different things, including ghost stories or haunted houses. So that was helpful. And no one had ever collected stories from Wisconsin or from the Midwest. So we were the first to come along and do this. But it took a long time. It's intensive research.
You must have traveled to all these different states then, too, huh?
Yes, yep. The initial research for Haunted Heartland, you know, Beth and I did. So she did some of the traveling. I did other places. We split it up. But whether it was something to see, you know, we tried to get there.
Well, we've been talking to Michael Norman, who is author of several collections of American supernatural stories. The most recent is a second edition of Haunted Heartland, published this past fall by the University of Wisconsin Press. Michael, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Jim. It was a delight, as always.
The inimitable Jim Oliver. Now, I use that word for two reasons. One, it's a true depiction, and two, who doesn't like saying inimitable? Another word for inimitable is incomparable, and we have another of those individuals coming up next on Spectrum West, the music and the man, David Gerald. Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the National Eagle Center in Wabasha, Minnesota, offering guided bald and golden eagle viewing field trips this winter. Registration is open at nationaleaglecenter.org/eagle-viewing. You're listening to Spectrum West on WPR. If you like the blues as a foundation, then coupled to a soul train that's carrying some rock, then David Gerald is your guy.
Walking up the street toward the sound of some fellas jamming in a rock and blues band. Just about the time I got close enough to see him, knew I'd hit the promised land. Oh, and young didn't matter, wouldn't know it. Jamming on them guitars getting done. Nah, nah. Soundman on the board, keyboard playing chords.
The David Gerald Band is returning Saturday night to the Heidi Center in Chippewa Falls. If you read about him, you'd notice he's identified as a blues soul rocker. And this Detroit guitar slinger is proud of that moniker because it tells you exactly what he likes to play. Loves to play. Well, I had the chance to talk with David Gerald just a couple days ago. Yeah, when I first heard the term blues soul rocker, I thought it might be a chair that someone brought to the Antiques Roadshow. But then I realized that it was the musical combination that is churning around inside David Gerald, the man with two first names. To find out how that combination implanted itself, I'd like to, if you don't mind, go back to the beginning. You were the youngest on what is kind of like a football team of kids, 11 to be exact, and often among accomplished musicians, it is learned that they come from musical households, or in your case, musical neighborhoods. You had a neighbor who helped along the process. Tell us about the guy with the guitars.
That's very true. I guess when I was around 14 or 15 years old, moved into an area on the northwest side of Detroit. I had a neighbor who was in a local band who would do block parties for the community.
Mm-hmm.
I was always into music and into guitars. So I befriended him, and he befriended me, and he realized that I was, a poor kid that didn't have a guitar or could afford to own one. So he would kind of help me out. Whatever, he had an instrument that didn't work anymore, he, kind of give it to me and have me kind of work on it. And it kind of worked out, and it totally worked out like that. I pieced together guitars, pieces of guitar necks, guitar bodies, pickups, anything I could piece together to get a guitar that I could play. I started out playing a saxophone in middle school, but I didn't own one of those either. So when we moved to a new neighborhood where the school couldn't provide the instrument, I had to figure out what to do because I knew I couldn't afford a saxophone.
Well, the age of 15 in some realms can be considered a bit late to pick up the guitar, but it doesn't seem to have restricted your development at all. There had to be. Tell us about the music that was around you as you learned to play. Did you have opportunities to collaborate with anybody, or where did your music come from?
Yeah, music was always around because both my parents are artistically talented, either both singing and both actually play a little bit.
Okay.
Of a guitar, not to the point where they actually owned one or anything like that, that I could play. So I listened to blues and gospel music with them. And my oldest brother picked up music, and he played the bass primarily. I'd play around on his bass as much as he would let me play that, which wasn't a lot, but I was definitely around him playing the saxophone in middle school. Mm-hmm. So music was always in the household. It was something I was going to do, whether or not I did it professionally or not. Like, you know, like the rest of my family, they didn't do it professionally, but it was always something I was going to be a part of or a part of my life.
Yeah, usually with guitar players, I like to ask them about either their first guitar. You had a bunch that were kind of Frankensteins that you put together from other guitars. Their first guitar, or how they learned their first song. And that usually comes from a book that somebody lent them or a record that they kept playing over and over and over. How did you get to learn your first stuff?
Interesting question. You know, I learned the first guitar stuff actually listening, you know, to the radio. I was fortunate to have a cassette deck that I would kind of put close to the radio, and I would record songs that had guitar parts in it that I actually liked. Rock guitars, a lot of rock guitars in the 80s really piqued my interest, which is the rocker portion of the moniker, the blues soul rocker moniker that I put out there. I couldn't remember the exact first song, but it was always some sort of pop rock type of song or a straight rock song.
And when you learned it, then did you play along with the cassette?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I'd play along to the best of my abilities. I'd get better and better, you know, at playing what I thought I was hearing with the guitarist to my satisfaction at some point. And that's pretty much how I started until I began to collect guitar magazines and understanding a little bit more from the artists. Perspective what they were doing, and I would correct whatever I wasn't doing, or I would keep what I was doing if I thought it worked better with how I wanted to approach the riff or the chord or something like that.
Sure. Well, that's a cool way to learn. Did you ever take a bona fide lesson?
Not really. The closest I got to a guitar lesson was in high school. I wasn't very focused on being disciplined at that time. I just wanted to do my thing. So I took a music class, but I didn't really get a lot out of it. I just wasn't focused as I should have been.
Well, you had other ways to focus, so... I don't think
I tell kids, don't do it like I did. It definitely, you know, be focused and learn it from a technical perspective, not just from a talent.
Yeah, but I'll bet you don't have too many regrets, do you?
I mean, not a whole heck of a lot.
Good.
One or two.
Good for you. Well, as early influences, you list people like Prince, Albert King, ZZ Hill, B.B. King, and Stevie Ray Vaughan, none of whom are physically around anymore, sadly, although their music surely lives and breathes. Do you feel like you're part of a fraternity whose job it is to continue their legacy and add to it? What can you add to the kinds of legacies that names like that leave?
You know, because they're so great, I really don't select that way because... No, for me to say that would really, really, really say that that's all I can do that. So I don't feel that way, but I definitely feel that they played a huge role in what I am becoming as an artist. So if anyone can draw from me what I drew from them, it would be the best I could do. But no, to follow in their shoes is way too big of shoes for me. But if someone feels... In fact, if someone gets to know them because of my music, then I'm good, because
cool.
That's how I got to know some of those guys.
Hey, baby, can I talk with you? Hey, baby, can I talk with you? I'd like to tell you how I feel about you.
Here's how I feel.
You just said the kind of musician I am becoming. Does that mean that you're always a work in progress?
Absolutely. Yeah. Everything, to me, you think about the arts, it's about exploring, thinking about yourself, you learn, and just growing, letting things become what they're going to become, let you become what you're going to become. And as an artist, I'm definitely, you know, evolving. I mean, I think just the way life, I think, is, you just evolve. So until my last breath, I'm becoming something.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
Yeah, you don't really want to get to some place where you say, well, there's nothing else to do.
Right. And for me, there's always going to be, because there's always going to be something more that interests me, because there always has been.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't see me settling and saying, okay, I'm as good as I want to get, or I've learned what I want to learn. I've performed what I want to perform, because there's so much different music that I listen to and I go, man, that is awesome. But I just don't have the time always at the moment to dig in. So I always want to. So if ever the time comes where I can dig in, I do that. So I'm definitely an evolving piece of work.
Good. That's the voice of David Gerald. He is a guitarist extraordinaire. He's bringing the David Gerald Band west to Wisconsin from Detroit, and they're entertaining at the Heide Center for the Arts in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin, Saturday. Showtime is at 7:30, and we are so happy they are coming because we like to rock and roll, if for no other reason than to stay warm.
I'm looking forward to it. We're very excited to be in there. We were there last year, and we had a great time, so we're hoping to meet our new friends. It's a wonderful venue, wonderful, wonderful people.
A lot of good musicians in Western Wisconsin as well. You were kind enough to send me your debut album called Hell and Back, including some great covers. The album's named after one of your original songs. What does Hell and Back mean? Is it about Detroit? Is it about losing jobs? I mean, the hell part's a downer, but the back part feels better.
Yeah, it's about all of that. Not just Detroit, but in particular, you know, because I was born and raised in Detroit, it's about a Detroit story. A lot of family, you know, in my neighborhood that I just observed as a very young person, before I was ever even able to do anything musically. I just watched this one family go through their process. And that song was about that. And as I became older, because they had kids, as I became older, I got to understand more of the adult aspect of the challenges of being poor in America, mm-hmm. or the world. But in my case, America, in Detroit in particular, and what that family was going through. And I always said to myself, if I ever got a chance to write about them, I was going to do that because I knew they weren't the only family going through something like that. So I was hoping I could reach some people and let them know, even if you're down, you can come back, just fight through it, don't give up. And at the end of that song and at the end of the story, it's about, you know, it can really be hellish. But if you don't give up, you can come through that. And that's pretty much what that song is about.
Yeah, good for you. You have another album coming out in the early spring. Tell us what's going to be on that one.
You know, I'm excited about this album. It's most of the way done. It's about the evolution that I spoke of, my evolving self. And this album is definitely blues influenced, but it's also bringing along my 80s rock and pop influence. So it's an evolution. It's a next step in the embryonic, if that's the word, process. Yeah, it's another step in the process. It's a blues rock soul album. So you're going to, I hope, feel the thing that you get when you're really feeling what the blues brings. And you're going to get the heavy guitar, which is what I really love. And I like to think, when I'm singing, I'm approaching it from a soul singer type of perspective. So you're gonna have that in there too. And that's pretty much right now what I am as an artist. And that's what you're gonna hear. I think you're gonna be able to hear all of my current influences, how it formed inside of me. And you're gonna certainly hear that music on this next album. I'm excited about it. Very excited about it. I wouldn't call it a blues album, but it's definitely blues influenced. And I would say anybody who gets into the blues, but it's not looking for the album to be a blues album, but can appreciate what the blues has birth, will appreciate this album.
Well, now look what you're up and did. You got us excited about it.
Well, I'm excited. I'm glad you're excited.
I have to say, as I told you in an email, that I'm a fan now, and I'll bet you it's happening for other people too. You're good.
Thank you. You know, if I'm reaching you, then I'm very happy about that, because that's what it's all about. Yeah. Music for me is about reaching folks. So thank you. Thank you for becoming, I'm going to call you a friend. It is what it is, but thank you for becoming a supporter of the music and helping put the message out there. I really appreciate it.
I'll be proud to call you a friend. Anyway, hey, are you aware of the blues scene in Western Wisconsin, Tuesday Night Blues?
I'm aware of it from an outsider perspective because I'm always trying to plug in to what's going on in our country, you know, in the blues and the blues rock scene. But I haven't gotten a chance to be a part of that, so hopefully I'm in the area, and when I'm riding through on a Tuesday, I can become a part of that.
Yeah, I'm hoping that Mike Fisher and the guys at the Chippewa Valley Blues Society are listening. You'd be somebody who I would trek down to Owen Park along the river to see on Tuesday night in that cool old historic band shell. That'd be right up your alley and right up everybody else's alley. David Gerald, thanks so much for being with us on WPR. Safe travels, stay warm, and have a heck of a good time Saturday in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin.
Thank you all. Stay well, and I'll see you soon.
If you're down and out, and you feel real hurt, come on over into the place where I work. Oh, loneliness. I'll try to do. I'll play. the blues for you.
David Gerald and the band, Heidi Center, Chippewa Falls, Saturday night, 7:30. Warm up a January evening in fine fashion. CVCA.net is the website. Tickets there by phone and at 726-9000 and at the door.
You might want to call.
Well, why do you say we catch up with Jim Oliver before he leaves? We need to know what's on stage.
Thanks, Al. The Eau Claire Children's Theater will present And Then They Came for Me Friday evening and Saturday and Sunday afternoons at the Oxford Theater. Chasing Christmas will play Friday and Saturday at the St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater in Hudson. The Chippewa Valley Theater Guild will present the female version of The Odd Couple, January 11th to the 14th and the 18th to the 21st at the Grand Theater in Eau Claire. An original musical show, Life Song, will be presented by Enrichment Through Culture of Cumberland Friday and Saturday and January 12th to the 14th in the Cumberland Arts Center. A dinner theater production of Ole and Lena's Ice Fishing Fandango will be staged January 11th to the 14th at the Heidi Center for the Arts in Chippewa Falls. The Eau Claire Children's Theater will present its annual mystery dinner production, Win, Lose, or Die, January 12th and 13th, 19th to the 20th, and the 26th to the 27th at the Oxford Theater. The Chippewa Valley Theater Guild will hold auditions for Driving Miss Daisy at 7 p.m. January 15th and 16th at the Grand Theater in Eau Claire. The Red Barn Theater of Rice Lake has scheduled auditions for its 2018 summer season, Saturday, January 13th and Saturday, January 20th, in the UW Barron County Fine Arts Building in Rice Lake from 9 a.m. to noon both days. And the Eau Claire Children's Theater has scheduled auditions for Julie B. Jones Is Not a Crook and the Addams Family for January 7th and the 8th at the Oxford Theater. I'm Jim Oliver.
Yes, you are. Hey, gang, no show next week. Places to go, people to see. But we'll be back on January 18th with another live program within which you will be able to participate. We're going to talk about the project called The Sounds of Eau Claire, a vigorous movement to document and archive the Renaissance and history of music in Eau Claire and the Valley, from large venues and festivals to family trees and traditions. It'll be fascinating and part of that live show on January 18th. Of course, Jim Oliver will be here. He's part of the Always More that we talk about on Spectrum West. Jim Oliver and friends. Thanks, Kate and Dean, and thank you guys for being in the audience. Stay as warm as you can, and I'll see you in a couple weeks, and be prepared to participate like you did last time. It's a lot of fun. See ya.